G'day everyone, Sean here. Just a quick disclaimer for this episode. A really fun episode, this one. It is a MIF fantasy draft for the Melbourne International Film Festival, which on the day of recording this will hopefully come out on the Monday, is only just 4 days away. It begins Friday, the 3rd of August, and runs all the way through to Sunday, the 20th of August. I've already got my passport, my deluxe membership, all ready to go. I've got seen 64 films, but I thought this would be a really fun episode and a fun way to talk about the films that we're excited to see, and in a fun and sort of semi-competitive fashion. But I need to do a quick disclaimer here at the beginning, is that we had two wonderful guests in Bea Jermyn and Chris Evans, who I'm incredibly grateful that they joined us, but we picked six films each, as we'll explain in the episode, but in the edit, I realized we accidentally only made Bede only picked five. I believe Chris cut him off when he was meant to pick two in a row, and he went straight into his next pick. But I have got Bede to do a quick recording, and that will be spliced into the audio of where he should have had that pick, but yeah, so if you're wondering why no one's sort of interacting with that, it's because Chris and I didn't hear it, and we don't really know what he said. As I'm recording this, I still haven't listened to it yet. I don't even know what film he's picked, but so just a disclaimer about that. And so if you're wondering why that seems a bit weird and a bit stilted, and the audio is not the same and is actually probably a better quality than the original recording, then that's why. But thought I'd let you guys all know, but I hope you enjoy this episode and stay subscribed and keep an eye out for more pods during MIF. Enjoy the episode. G'day everyone, and welcome to another bloody movie podcast. Everybody's favorite movie podcast that almost always just starts to get going, but then never fucking does. But you know what? For the 70th or however many ever times we've been on the air, we are finally back. And you know why? Because it's beginning to look a lot like MIFmas here in Melbourne. That was horrible. I have a horrible singing voice. But yes, MIF is back!
No. You carried it.
Glad
you
to hear. It. Yes, Melbourne International Film Festival is back. It's Melbourne's own winter wonderland here in Melbourne from August the 3rd all the way through to the 20th. And we're doing something a little bit different on today's show. We are doing a... inspired by a lot of other podcasts, a lot of movie podcasts like The Ringer and other ones, they do these really fun movie drafts. But I've never seen them really do one for a film festival or one for an upcoming film festival. So I thought an interesting idea that we could do is do a fantasy draft for the upcoming Melbourne International Film Festival, which starts just next week. And I mean, I can't do this alone. I've got two very, very special guests. Bede has not been. Both new first-time guests of the podcast. First of all, fellow podcaster extraordinaire and other MIF tragic, Bede Jermyn. How are you today?
I'm good, thanks, Sean. How are you?
It's way too late to be doing this podcast, but I am fine. I'm absolutely fine. And our second guest, I thought I had an absolute get for this episode. I thought I had the Chris Evans to be here on this podcast today. Captain America himself. But turns out it's just some other guy in Sydney that has his same name. Chris Evans, thanks for joining us.
That's me. it's funny. Sean's been on the podcast I used to do a couple of times, and this is my first time on his podcast. That show is called Film Fight Club. It's a very SEO unfriendly name, but if you manage to find the podcast, you'll find Sean on there in a few episodes. Anyway, it's good to be podcasting again.
Yeah.
It's been too long.
Yeah. Also, I think one of your last episodes of Film Fight Club that I believe has not been published.
Yeah. I'll make it pre-MIF goal to get that online finally, just to, say goodbye to loose ends.
Just to finally lay it to rest. No, it was exactly, a great show that you did up with past guest of the show, Glenn Falkenstein, and also the great Virat Nehru. Hello, Virat, if you're listening. They did it for 2SER, community radio station in Sydney. Great show. Ran for about, 5 years or so?
5 years, yeah.
Great stuff. And as I said, cheers. I had the pleasure of being on there. It was a great show. I really thought that more people should have listened to you while you're on the air. It was
Cheers. Yeah.
Excellent show. But I've been wanting to get Chris on this podcast pretty much ever since I met him. So thrilled to finally have him on. And also for coming on short notice for this podcast. But yeah, so a MIF draft. There are some rules to this. This isn't the Wild West. So we have a predetermined draft order. So we put all three of our names into a random list generator. Bede's name came out first, then Chris's, then myself. And we get 6 picks each, and we're going to do it in a snake order draft. So how it's going to go, every two, like there's 6 rounds. So 6 picks between the three of us for the 6 rounds. Bede is going to go first with pick 1, then Chris with 2, then me with pick 3. But then in terms of a snake order, the order reverses. So I have the first pick in round 2. So, and then the order reverses and just keeps going until we get to the end. And there are a few criteria that we all have to meet in terms of this draft as well. And I've completely forgotten what that is. So let me bring that back up again. So... yeah, okay, well, yes, this might work better if the other guests can contribute with this as well, even though I am, I guess, the draft master, the draft king. But yes, Chris, go through the criteria we must follow for our 6 picks.
One film from the headliner's strand, the main event films. One from the Bright Horizons, which is newcomers and breakthroughs. One documentary. One Australian film. And one film either directed or co-directed by a woman must be included in everyone's draft.
Yes, and these criteria like can apply to one film. So say if you pick an Australian documentary that's directed or co-directed by a woman, that's all of your picks. That's all of those criteria met in the one film. So you can be really clever about this if you want to. You can just have more space to just pick the movies that you want. But I have no idea what I'm going to select. I gave these guys I gave Bede about a day's notice and Chris about maybe 4 or 5 hours to come up with a short list. So we'll see how this goes. So Bede, and where there's no time limit on this, we'll take as normally with these things, there's a bit of a time limit to crack the pressure on. But I thought this would just be a way to make this like talk about the MIF program, just not in a boring way of like, oh, I want to see this. Oh, I want to see this. I thought it would be a fun, but also sort of lighthearted and semi-competitive a way to talk about this. So Bede, with pick 1, what are you going to select for the MIF 2023 MIF Fantasy Draft?
All right, I'm going to go with probably the biggest heavy hitter from the film festival this year, and that, of course, is the Palme d'Or winning film Anatomy of a Fall by Justine Triet, I believe. So, Triet, okay. Of course, one of the big reasons I picked this one is obviously it recently won the Palme d'Or, so any film that wins that prize at Cannes, it automatically is going to be on the top of my list to watch if it does end up playing at MIF. And also, I do love a good courtroom drama, and this one sounds like it has a really interesting hook to it in terms of its plot. And I've heard nothing but amazing things about it, and some people have already talking about this being one of the year's best films. So that's hence why I picked that as my first pick for this draft.
Yeah, so I'm lucky in that being in Sydney, I've already seen Anatomy of a Fall and a number of the movies, which might make this draft easy for me to pick things that you guys won't be picking.
You do have a bit of an unfair advantage in that on that front.
Yep. But Anatomy of a Fall is great. I strongly recommend it to everyone. It's really accessible. A good courtroom drama should be. And it's very smart and it's very well acted. And I think you're in for a treat. I'm picking a film that I've been waiting for ages, which is Showing Up from Kelly Reichardt. It's meant to be a bit of a departure as far as her work is concerned, because it's a comedy. And in its scope, it seems to be evoking something more like Old Joy or Wendy and Lucy, but with a much lighter tone as far as her filmography is concerned. I've been hearing great things about this movie since last Cannes. Not the Cannes that Anatomy of a Fall won Palme d'Or at, the one where it was Triangle of Sadness. The one where Triangle of Sadness.
The
one where Triangle of Sadness was the winner. So if you'll excuse the very obvious joke, I've been waiting a while for this film to show up, and I'm glad to finally be given the chance to see it in the cinema. It seems like a very Melbourne film too. It's about the life of an artist and the minor distractions. Sorry, I'm just stereotyping your city from a Sydney perspective.
No, go. But go right ahead.
Yeah, it's described as being about the little distractions and slice of life kind of portrait of how someone goes about living as an artist with a kind of faintly absurd comedy to it. I'm really intrigued. Again, also, I've heard great things about it.
Yeah, normally those sorts of films, and also I guess maybe Bede as a fellow country mouse who's moved to the city, I don't know, I find that a lot of those films can be, like, insufferable a lot of times. Like, movies about, like, you know, a movie about artsy wankers for artsy wankers just annoy the absolute piss out of me. But Kelly Reichardt, like, I have trust in her that she can actually do something a little bit different with that and actually bring a bit of, you know, heart to it and actually make something very good from it.
I've heard it's also kind of faintly judgmental of the characters, which might be refreshing in this context.
Yeah, yeah, I hope so. Like, Nicole Holofcen as "You Hurt My Feelings" like sort of had a similar sort of tone to that as well, where it's a little bit judgmental of these characters in that sort of way and like the decisions they make. But as we move on to pick number three, now I have no idea what I'm going to pick, and now I have to do two in a row. So this will be fascinating. Speaking of another film that's taken a long time to show up, but is also on here, and I've noticed all three of us have knocked off the female the female directors and also headliners all in the first round, because a filmmaker that I've slowly begun to love after slowly getting through her films is Joanna Hogg. And another film that's taken a long time to get to Australia is The Eternal Daughter.
Yep.
And very, very excited to see this one. It's double the Tilda Swinton. What more could you want, really? And, you know, this is a companion piece with The Souvenir, specifically The Souvenir Part 2. I think it's just going to be fascinating, fascinating viewing.
Yeah, I'm super keen. This was also on my list of potential candidates, so I guess won't be on my draft, but I really loved The Souvenir Part 2. I thought it dodged, speaking of films getting insufferably self-indulgent and self-absorbed, it dodged a lot of the traps of movies about movies and filmmakers writing about filmmakers, and gave a really, I think, personal story about how art actually comes together and how it's actually made. I'm really keen to see what she does next. The pairing with Tilda Swinton, I'm curious to see it explored further. Given how atmospheric both Souvenir films were and how Souvenir 2 in one sequence almost hints towards her capacity for making a ghost story, I'm really interested to see how Hogg explores this kind of territory.
The Eternal Daughter is not on my list this year, but I have a feeling it's going to be coming out very soon, because I'm kind of stuck with movies that I know that are probably going to take a while to get released, or they don't have release dates yet. So something like Showing Up or The Eternal Daughter, I have a feeling, will pop up eventually. I know Showing Up doesn't have a distributor yet, but I have a feeling it's going to at some point.
It's taken long enough, which is the thing that's making me hesitant expect anything. Yeah, it's been more than a year, as I said, and we'll see.
Now, as for my second pick, as for pick number four, since I get two in a row, I'm going to move over to Bright Horizons and tick one of these off here. And there's two films I'm tossing up between here, and it's just a matter of whether it's ticking boxes in our criteria and which meets most of them, or the ones that I am genuinely most interested in. And part of that is, I think I'm going to select in the Bright Horizons category is the directorial debut of noted cinematographer Sean Price Williams, a film called The Sweet East. Now, Sean Price Williams, you know, probably one of the, you know, most notable independent cinematographers going around at the moment, working with the likes of Alex Ross Perry and the Safdie brothers. So, and I love the way his films look too. So seeing him, a directorial debut from him, is a very exciting concept. And I believe it's also a script from a film critic, Nick Pinkerton, who's actually coming to the festival as well to present the film.
I really like Nick's writing. I don't so much like him on Twitter because I'm becoming increasingly allergic to extreme irony. And it sounds like this film is very much operating in that mode. But Nick is a really, as I said, intelligent writer and definitely a provocateur. And combined with the visuals of Sean Price Williams and how he reveals himself as a director, I'm very curious to see how this one turns out.
So, Chris, we're on to you next.
Okay, so for the Bright Horizons film, I'm really curious to see Inside the Yellow Cocoon Shell. It's a spiritualist slow cinema film from Vietnam. It had some of the best, I would say it seems to have had the best reviews of the director's fortnight at the last Cannes Film Festival. And that is this year's Cannes Film Festival. It also won the Camera d'Or for Best First Feature. Anything that's been raved to the extent that this film has been has my attention. It's drawn comparisons to a Pichit Pongwe aesthetical and also hold on. Sorry, I'm tired. I'm mentally blanking. Theo Angelopoulos. Yeah. I can go either way with slow cinema, but when it hits, it really hits. I'm increasingly drawn to spiritualist, transcendentalist type filmmaking, and the meaning, I guess, that we can find in art that explores these dimensions. And hearing what I've heard about this film, I think it has really great potential to be a really beautiful experience.
The sort of stuff that makes Paul Schrader believe in cinema again.
Exactly, exactly. But yeah, it's about a spiritual quest, essentially, a journey for meaning.
Yeah, I am interested to see this one. And also, like, yeah, there's only a couple of screenings and they're already, like, as of time of recording, one of them is on standby. There's three screenings. I think this is also going to be on MIFF Play as well. So if you can't get to the festival...
Yes, it is. Yeah. But it sounds like a film that would really benefit from being seen in a cinema, so...
I hope so. If I can find the time to see it, because this is just a hair over 3 hours as well.
Yes.
So, you know, tread lightly, I guess.
It does make it difficult, yeah.
All right. We're back to Bede, who has two in a row now. And I'm interested to see where he goes from here.
Well, I think, I sort of was looking at the Bright Horizons section, and Inside the Yellow Cocoon Shell is one of only two films from this section I am checking out in the film festival, but the other one happens to be a film that's part of also the MIFF Premiere Fund films for this year, and that's The Rooster, starring Hugo Weaving. And it's also the writing and directorial debut for Mark Leonard Winter. And from the sounds of it, like, it could go either way based on its plot, because it is about the relationship between a hermit and a cop, and it also deals with mental illness as well. So it could go either way, especially given that it's also, I believe, Winter's directorial debut as well. But regardless, whatever the outcome for this film is, you just know somebody like Hugo Weaving is always going to put in a top-notch performance in it. But so I'm very curious. And plus, you know, one of the things I like to do at MIFF every year is try to see as many Australian films as I possibly can. And given that this one is going to make its world premiere there, I just knew I just had to put this one on the list and check it out.
Definitely. I feel like this was the other Bright Horizons film I was considering drafting here. You have me sold on Hugo Weaving as a crazy old man, and I'm extremely excited to see that. This is another film that I'm seeing during the festival. It really feels like it could go either way with me, though. Like, I wasn't that as convinced by the trailer, but, like, it's an interesting concept that something about the trailer just didn't click with me. But I hope to be proven wrong, and I'm seeing this in the session that they have at IMAX. So to see a film like this, like a Victorian produced film up on an IMAX screen would be great. And I am loving that Viggo Mortensen for whatever reason. I'm seeing a film with him in the festival though, Eureka, maybe featuring the draft from one of us later. But where was I going with this? But Hugo Weaving, I love that he's sort of not necessarily stopped making Hollywood films, but like he's sort of giving back to Australian cinema a bit more in his more recent years. Yeah.
Yeah, and he always seems to pop up in like at least one or two films at MIFF every year. Like the last couple of years, it's like, oh, it's not a MIFF film festival if Hugo Weaving doesn't show up at least in one or two of the films that are playing.
Mm. Mm. It's a couple of things that definitely make a MIFF. I think there has to be at least like 7 movies that involve a goat in them at some point. There's always goats in MIFF films for whatever reason. There has to be. It is illegal to hold a MIFF if Hong Sang-soo does not make a film. It's illegal. And yeah, because he's got another one. I think he makes like 2. He makes like 17 films a year.
Yeah, I saw one at Sydney Film Festival in Water, and I think there's a different one here.
Yeah, Walk Up or Walk In, yeah. something along those lines. But anyway, we are getting distracted because it is Bede's pick number 7. He gets 2 in a row. We're back.
Yes, I believe this is a documentary. So
you don't have to go one... in. I should have mentioned as well. Oh. You don't have to go in order, as well. Like okay. you can go in any order you want. It's just easier to, you know, if you want to do that, that's fine. But you know,
yeah, definitely.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'll go with documentary to begin with. And surprisingly, I don't have that many documentaries on my list this year, which is kind of surprising. I've only got 3 of the 40 I plan on seeing this year. But one of the ones I kind of changed up at the very last minute, mainly because this is definitely one that would have to be seen on the big screen, and that's Wim Wenders, and I'm probably going to butcher the name, so please forgive me.
You got it right.
I think. Yeah, okay. So it's a documentary on art world luminary and Anselm Kiva, and Wim Wenders did this documentary in 3D. So the last time Wim Wenders did a documentary in 3D was the Oscar-nominated Pina. So, and given that, you know, he is a very great, like his narrative work as of late has kind of been all over the place, at least for me. But his documentary work has still been pretty strong. So I look forward to checking this one out. But the fact that it is also going to be shown in 3D as well definitely makes me even more intrigued to check it out in that format, especially since this will probably be one of the few only times you'll get to see it in that format, at least on the big screen. And yeah, I'm definitely taking up the opportunity to see it while it's playing.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's really good. And you absolutely should take the opportunity to see it in 3D. I'd say it's pretty essential to the full impact of this film. He uses 3D extremely well. The film's a bit of a sequel to Pina in terms of its approach in general, actually. Just, you know, rather than going into all too much talking head stuff, it's just like interesting 3D staging of the artwork that the titular artist is known for. But speaking of his narrative work, though, he's had a real return to form this year with Perfect Days, which is also in the headliners section. Yep. I recommend everyone check that out as well. It's really wonderful. Talking around after its screenings at Sydney, everybody liked it.
Yeah, I look forward to that one as well. And that is on my list of films to check out because I sort of noticed in the last few years I've been attending MIFF, there's always like that one filmmaker who I at least see 2 of their yep. work at MIFF every year. Like previous years it was like Terrence Malick and a few others as well, so I'm definitely taking the opportunity to kind of see both his films at the festival this year, and being that it's both a narrative film and a documentary makes me even more excited.
But it's funny because Perfect Days is a somewhat documentary like narrative film, and Anselm is a somewhat narrative like documentary film. Vim keeps on blurring the lines.
Fascinating. Interesting. No, so, came for both of them.
Yeah. So for documentaries, I'll pick one I was going to see at Sydney Film Festival. It was a late edition here, but I was too fried at the end of the festival. I was stressing out over minor things, and I was advised by friends, no, you probably shouldn't go and see 4 Daughters, which would have been the last movie I saw at Sydney Film Fest. But I have it on good authority from those I was able to talk into going to the screening, who were then not joined by me, that it's devastating, as its synopsis suggests. It's about four daughters of a mother in Tunisia, two of whom left to join ISIS. And it's a hybrid of interviews with the mother and the two daughters who are remaining and reconstructions. So again, continuing that theme of blurring the lines between fiction and documentary, which it sounds like quite a few films at the festival are doing. But I found the subject matter really intriguing. And yeah, I've heard good things both from Khan and from my friends at Sydney. So yeah, I'll be there to check it out. I have to say the at least one film directed by a woman task has proven to be extremely easy because honestly, between what I've chosen and my alternative picks in case I got pipped, it feels like most of the movies I want to see are directed by women. So this one is as well.
MIFF have been good in the at least with ever since I've been going to MIFF of having almost 50-50 in terms of the in terms of representation of both men and women as in the directorial space. And then, but that comes back to me now. But yeah, Four Daughters. That wasn't even on my radar, so I'll definitely have to look into that and see if I can fit that one in now. Because it wasn't on my radar. Didn't know anything about it. I think I might have scrolled past it.
It's an intriguing premise, yeah, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, speaking of intriguing premises, since we're going down the list and we're going to documentaries, but I'll choose an Australian documentary for mine. And this, I believe, this one's part of the Premiere Fund. This is just one of the ones that you pick because it's about a fascinating subject and specifically one that just will just feel like just give you the warm and fuzzies. It is a film called This Is Going to Be Big. It is a documentary about this neurodivergent school that comes together and they put on a musical that is a John Farnham themed time traveling extravaganza.
Okay.
I mean, I just want to see what that looks like.
John Farnham is very fertile ground for irony, I think. It's, you know, like a maximal Australian cultural cringe.
Absolutely. And, you know, putting the time travel layer on top of that. But I feel like, you know, within, you know, his, in terms of with John Farnham's personal life and like, you know, his health battles and things like that, I feel like this is going to be not necessarily more made out of love or like a hagiography to John Farnham. It's more going to be about these children and like this play, putting on this play. And, you know, it's a school of neurodivergent children. So it's going to be, you know, about them sort of expressing themselves and in ways that they can't. And, you know, I myself am a neurodivergent person. And oftentimes I feel like documentaries about neurodivergent people take a massive right turn into something completely different, or they're not really made with the neurodivergent people in mind. This one I have a little bit more faith in. That could be completely misplaced, but given the subject matter of this film and, you know, I want to see what this musical looks like, even if it is through like a, you know, the documentary and behind the scenes sort of lens.
Yeah, sweet. It's funny, when looking through the program, it didn't occur to me that that was actually a documentary. I thought it was a feature for some reason. So I imagined something extremely sort of like weird hipster irony. You can totally see it, Sundance.
I could see, if you look,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if you look at just the promotional image that they use, like I could easily say why you'd get that idea. But yeah, this is another one that's going to be on MIFF Play as well if you don't catch it in the festival. And I believe this is also made for Netflix, I believe. So right, it'll probably be on Netflix within within the next 12 months or so. But yeah, try and see it at the festival if you can. This is another one that's already selling out. So yeah, get around it. I'm keen to see this one.
Yeah, this one's also on my list as well. And yeah, I'm looking forward to checking this one out as well. This one, again, like a few films, this was a very late addition to it as well, because I read that synopsis. I thought, okay, this sounds pretty intriguing. So I put it on the list.
All right. But so we're back to me again, and I have no clue what the hell to pick. So I'll just go to, in times like these, just so I don't waste too much time, I'll just fall back onto, a favorite of mine. And I believe Chris has seen this film, but I think it was a victim of festival fatigue, so he didn't really engage with it that much. It is one of my favorite filmmakers working, Jafar Panahi's new film, No Bears. Nothing more needs to be said. This guy's kind of a hero of mine. Love the way he goes about his work. Just, if he has another film, I'm going to go see it. It's as simple as that.
I'm the same way with Panahi. I was shocked to have basically no response to the film at all, but I promised to rewatch it and give it another chance. From what I understand of the film, if you like Panahi, you'll like this. It's his usual bag of tricks and a few new ones, and it's on the heavier end as far as his recent work is concerned.
Okay. Is it still, I was going to say, for someone who's seen it, is it still sort of that, has that sort of playfulness and that sort of, you know, similar to what you were talking about with Wim Wenders earlier, sort of blurring the line between documentary and fiction?
It's very playful.
A little bit more like straightforward narrative.
No, it's blurring the lines for sure. It's metafiction, and it is extremely playful, but playful almost seems like the wrong word when you're dealing with such heavy subject matter as this film does. I would say it's very creative. Even just the opening scene is a pretty amazing feat when you see it. And you know, just what's always inspiring to me about Panahi, many things are inspiring to me, but one of them is how he's clearly using such limited resources, yet the pure creativity in his filmmaking really elevates this to being as visually engaging as a CGI driven blockbuster, more so because there's actual ideas running in the background. But yeah, he's an extremely inventive filmmaker, and he's clearly iterating on a central idea that he has been for a while, but he's not resting on his laurels while he's doing that.
I believe that's back to you, Chris.
I'll grab an Australian film because I think it's the most intriguing one. Shida. It's social realism, kitchen sink type stuff, which for me can be hit and miss, but I heard very good things about this film. And yeah, it starts and ends with that. It's about an Iranian refugee in a women's shelter in Australia. It features the lead actress from Holy Spider, who gave a very good performance in that film. And yeah, from what I've heard, it's quite simple in a very emotionally direct way and quite touching. And yeah, I'd like to support a really good Australian film, which it sounds like this one is.
Yeah, this one I think I was kind of debating back and forth whether to have on my list or not, but I just sort of found out, I believe, earlier today that the film's coming out in late September. So I figured, yeah, I think I could easily wait on this one.
Fair call.
A little bit longer. Yeah, but that being said, though, I am looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, through Mad Men Films, I believe, too, on September 28th, this is getting a release. I'm still going to go see it. And like, as you said, all of those things that Chris said there, that's perfectly suited for a film for an opening night of the festival, which this is the opening night film. You know, it was one of the best, like, next to Talk to Me, I think it was the best reviewed Australian film out of Sundance. So, yeah. Interested to see where this goes. And yeah, the lead actress who in Holy Spider, she was very good in that movie, but
yeah,
in an otherwise pretty lackluster film, I thought. But yeah, so
I agree.
The fact that Australian cinema can get a Cannes Best Actress winner into their sort of film, that's good for our industry. And I hope this film does well both at the festival and for its general release. And I'm excited to see it. We're going to say that about all of these films, otherwise we wouldn't pick them. So it's
true.
Feels like a moot point. But
exactly.
On that note, Bede, what movie are you looking forward to next that you are going to draft?
You know, it's funny. I was sort of looking over my list and of all the films that I have like on there. And I got to, like, Sean, you know me. I'm a genre guy. I'm a huge horror fan. And the one that I'm looking forward to most from the film festival this year is Late Night with the Devil from the Cain brothers, who of course did 100 Bloody Acres and Scare Campaign. This is their third film. This one is an Australian co-production, but it stars David, and I'm probably going to butcher his last name, so please forgive me, David Dasmalchian, who has been popping up in a lot of films
over the last everything.
Like, I think he's literally in about 7 or 8 films just this year. Like, he has been everywhere, but mainly as a supporting player. But this is one of the films that's coming out this year. This was the one where he's actually the lead in. And the premise of it sounds very intriguing to me. And it is also a Halloween film as well, because it's set on Halloween. And it also kind of reminds me of a few horror films that I've seen over the years, like Ghost Watch yeah. or the WNUF Halloween special and a few others. And it's a mixture of found footage and documentary. So I'm very much looking forward to this. And it sounds really cool. And it's been getting nothing but really strong reviews when it played at the South by Southwest Film Festival. So, and of course I've enjoyed the Cain's Brothers previous work, so I'm definitely down for this one.
I wasn't able to catch it at Sydney because of scheduling problems, but I heard really good things. I also heard it's pretty much packed out with excellent American accents from an Australian supporting cast. So a good fake American movie.
Wow. Yeah, not... And it was shot here in Melbourne as well.
Awesome. Wow. Yeah, that's sick. Because normally that is like the cinematic, the kiss of death for Australian cinemas is them pretending or them being ashamed of being Australian and being very bad at not being Australian. Particularly like a film, what was it, Ascension? It was that genre movie about like the evil elevator or something like that. Not M. Night Shyamalan's Devil. It was a similar one, but that was another film where I'm like, this movie feels so ashamed to be Australian, and it is frustrating. It would be so much better if you just accepted you were Australian and be done with it and just be Australian. But no, so that gives me a bit of hope. And yeah, David Dismalkian, he's like probably our next great character actor, I think, working today. Like, directors must love the guy. He's got a very distinct look to him. He brings this sort of intensity, but also, you know, this sort of weird, strange energy, like, you know, like a Rami Malek type, like early on in his career, where, like, you know, but both just showed up in Oppenheimer recently, actually. So, and yeah, this sounds like the most South by Southwest movie to ever exist. So, but like, you know, fun genre stuff from Australian, like, I'm there.
Oh, definitely. And also, like, it's weird that this guy who just popped up in a small part in The Dark Knight all those years ago, it is now one of the most sought after character actors in Hollywood at the moment.
Wait, who was he in The Dark Knight again?
Oh, he was the fake Joker in Bruce Wayne finds in the scene with all the police officers.
The hockey pads, that one?
Not him. I'm trying to remember the scene now. I just know it's like the scene where they're basically doing the fake funeral for Commissioner Gordon, and I believe it is Bruce Wayne it's pretty much like, one of the people he finds and removes a mask is David. So that was his first on-screen role in a film, and it's kind of come full circle because that bit part, of course, led him back to Nolan with Oppenheimer as well.
Well, I guess another film that I'm very much looking forward to seeing at MIFF this year is, of course, Todd Haynes' new film, May December, starring Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman. Like, I sort of was looking up the plot summary of it recently, and even though, yes, it's definitely the type of premise that could easily be done in the wrong way, but the fact is, based on the word I've heard about it out of Cannes, when it played there as part of the film festival, it sounds like they're kind of going for this very campy melodrama in terms of the type of how they're going to tackle the film's controversial story. And knowing that Todd Haynes is behind it, like, it makes sense that he would want to go into that direction, because if you've seen a lot of Todd Haynes' films, like, he's definitely a filmmaker who every now and again isn't afraid to take on a campy story. And I think this one in particular, I'm very curious to see how this one turns out. And so far it's getting a lot of good buzz, but I think the main thing that I'm just really looking forward to seeing it, and like I said before, was definitely that it's a much more campier film than people expected it to be. So that one in particular is one of the main reasons why I'm very excited about seeing it at MIFF this year.
I've lost count of how many. So that's five from Bede. So we're in the fifth round, I believe. So I think we have two each, but Bede has one more. So Chris,
I'm going to pick La Chimera from Alicia Ruwacha. I've enjoyed all her films so far, but I was really, really taken with Happy Lazaro, or Happy as Lazaro, as they called it here. I thought that was a huge leap forward, and I was really taken with the magical realism of it, and the rural setting that she's explored also in The Wonders, and the kind of Fellini-esque nature of it. And this film seems to be taking all of those aspects further. It sounds really intriguing, like a contemporary fairy tale, tackling big themes about life and death, mythological ideals. Yeah, I'm really super keen. I think she's one of the most exciting filmmakers working today. Did you see Abby's Lazaro, Sean? Or Bede?
I did not. That was the film that I missed.
I had seen it, yeah.
Yeah, that was a film that I missed when it was in both the Melbourne Film Festival and then also the Italian Film Festival and then also its general release. So right. But that was years ago. So I've had like time to catch up and just haven't. I have, however, seen Rohrwacher's short that she did for Disney Plus, La Pupille or whatever that was. That was incredible. That was genuinely just gave you all the warm and fuzzies, and it was just, you know, perfect Christmas time viewing. Would not surprise me if that goes into like the canon of like, you know, Christmas specials people watch every year.
I need to see it still. She's such a good director.
Yeah, and I'm intrigued with this one because like I believe it's half of it is in English as well. And I believe Josh O'Connor, who I think is a really, really promising young British actor, I think he's has a lead in it too. So I'm interested to see where it goes from there.
I hear he also speaks fluent Italian in the film.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
He's meant to be a British character, but he also speaks Italian. Yeah, everything about this one sounds interesting to me, like the kind of carnivalesque atmosphere of it, the setting, the characters. I don't know. I just love Fellini. I wish there were more people trying to channel Fellini than just Paolo Sorrentino, who is getting at sort of one aspect of Fellini, but missing a lot of the cuddliness and warmth and whimsical nature of some of his earlier work. And but I don't think Rohrwacher is just biting Fellini. I think she has her own voice as well. I'm just saying I'd like to see people exploring these sorts of maximalist emotionality and sincerity more in contemporary cinema, I guess.
Well, at least from what I've seen, like La Pupille definitely has that. So it's made me want to go back to see all of Rohrwacher's other films, but
I'll have to check it out.
But
who wants to have Disney Plus? That's the problem.
Yeah, especially now. I don't know if did you hear about this? Did you hear about this? I'll impersonate Jay Leno for a second. Did you hear about this?
Okay.
Disney are taking physical media off their shelves.
I heard that. No more Australian physical media from Disney. It doesn't surprise me from Disney though.
So what was it? So Guardians 3 will be the last one, I think they said.
Pretty incredible that there won't be physical media of any of the Marvel movies or any of the live-action Disney remakes or whatever in Australia at all. Like, end of an era for sure.
I mean, I think it just shows they don't want permanency in anything. Like, of the things they make, they don't want it to be permanent. They just want it to be here and now, like literally something you consume and then never think about ever again.
Yeah, it's and just they want to be able to control your access to things like a license.
Mm.
Yeah, we should be up in arms about it as cinephiles. So that's why I will not subscribe to Disney Plus. I'll use a free trial and watch La Pupille. I don't have that much integrity. We'll see.
I'm just torrent it. hey, certain filmmakers have said that's the best form of distribution. So I remember Abel Ferreira and Werner Herzog have said that. So,
well, it's looking more and more necessary from an archival perspective, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. All right, but now we're over to me, and again, no idea what the hell to pick because I'm trying to moderate this, but then also engage with you guys in what you're saying, but I might go with another Australian film. Good luck if you are seeing this one and you were the only people who got tickets for it, because this, I think, was either the first film to sell out both of its screenings or was very, very close to it. This is an Australian, it says comedy, drama and thriller. It's a film called Bird Eater, which I believe played at Sydney Film Festival. It's from, I believe it's the debut. Yeah, I believe it's the debut feature or from two young Australian filmmakers named Jack Clark and Jim Weir, who collectively call themselves Fax Machine. And this is basically like a wake and fright pastiche almost, where, you know, a bachelor party takes a feral turn, and I believe the bride is actually invited to the bachelor party, and, you know, it things just go out of control very quickly, and, you know, it'll sort of confront the idea of the Australian man and sort of like toxic masculinity. Always intrigued to, you know, Wake and Fright, I think, is a genuine masterpiece, one of my favorite films of all time. So any film that sort of riffs on that, I have high expectations for, but I'm always interested to see what they sort of do with something like this.
Have you heard about the Royal Hotel?
I have. That's the like sort of narrative version of Hotel Coolgardie with, and I think it has what, Julia Garner and Jessica Hennick
as
the leads that's playing it. Tiff. Yeah.
But
And Kitty Green's.
That's right. Yeah.
That sounds like it's interesting because that also sounds like it's going to be a Wake and Fright with gender politics at taking more of a central part of the narrative. So it'll be interesting to compare these two films, one with, you know, Hollywood backing and one that couldn't be more homegrown.
That's the thing, like, you know, as both of you already said, like Wake and Fright is, you know, an absolute masterpiece of Australian cinema. So, and it's funny that we got two movies that could possibly be their own types of riffs on it. And I did manage to snag a ticket for Birdeater. So I'm looking forward to checking that one out. So I'll report back once I've seen it.
Full disclosure, I don't know if the filmmakers have ever actually said in interviews or even in any things that they've said that this is a Wake and like a Wake and Fright pastiche or like a sort of Wake and Fright esque, like if they've made any sort of comparisons to it.
But we're all thinking it, aren't we? We're all thinking it.
Yeah.
And it's not a bad thing. As you say, Wake and Fright's a great film.
Yeah.
That gets at a lot of things about Australia that I think a lot of us are uncomfortable talking about.
And I think it's very pointed, and I think you can only really get that perspective from somebody outside of Australia. You know, get a Bulgarian Canadian like Ted Kotcheff to make that movie, and you know, because you need an outside lens looking into Australia to be like, this is fucked. Like everything you've got going on here is fucked. And even then in the early 70s, probably even late 60s when they were developing that film, like not much has really changed. But as I try and find one last film for my last selection, this may take some time, so feel free to pad while I do this. Part of me wants to select one of the like VR things that they've got, which is In Search of... I might even select this because this... Let me just try and find it. Yeah. Fuck it. Look, because MIFF offers more than just, you know, your more traditional cinema. More so recently, like probably within the last maybe like 5-10 years, have started to bring sort of like 360 film and VR, like augmented reality, extended reality. I think that's what they call XR or things like that. But yeah, they have one this year, which sounds really, really fascinating. It is from a UK artist called Darren Emerson. It's a documentary of sorts, but it's called In Pursuit of Repetitive Beats. And it's sort of this, you know, as the program guide says, a euphoric multisensory joyride into 1980s acid house.
Nice.
And so it's sort of, I believe you're sort of in the mode of this person who's just looking to find their next rave. But interesting part, and what's a selling point to me, is not only just do you have the VR headset on, a part of this as well is also a haptic vest. So there's also, it's to create the sensation of like physical impact on the body. So
the beats.
That could either be incredible, but also horrifying.
That's, so that there sounds is fantastic.
There is a morbid curiosity to me towards this one. And because I'll need to double check to see, because I do want to do this. And I believe the VR experience is about like the work itself is about 40 minutes long. But, you know, because it's VR, like they only have certain spots like within like each hour. So I think it's they tend to sell out very quickly. So this is one I'm definitely, definitely interested in seeing. And I'm hoping that I can squeeze this in because this sounds incredible.
It does. It's funny, before you mentioned the haptic vest, I was thinking VR sounds like a really good way to get you in the mindset of a rave, but then hearing that, I'm sure there'll be some other uses of it, you'll be able to feel the real body shaking bass without speakers playing at a blasting level. It sounds very smart.
And look, I am not the target demo for this sort of stuff. Like, I've never been to a doof or like any sort of rave in my life. So, I mean, this might be the closest I ever get to it. So, you know, I'm a loser, I know, but like, if this is the way I can experience it.
Why don't you kill me?
But yeah, that's me done. That's my draft done. I'm happy with my picks. I'll go back over them if I can remember them at the end. But before we do that, Chris, your last pick.
I'll just add that you're not a loser because you have two very fine winning gentlemen joining you for this conversation tonight.
And I'm very thankful. Very thankful to them for them to join me in here.
Cheers. So I'll add for my last pick, Master Gardener. This is another film I've been waiting ages to actually it wasn't so long, it was only Venice last year, wasn't it? This I think it's called the God's Lonely Man trilogy, the trilogy of First Reformed and The Card Counter is completed with this film. I really enjoyed both those films. The Card Counter I initially heard was a letdown after First Reformed, but I ended up being blown away by it, and Master Gardener is the worst received of the three. But certain people love it. I think I'm really in tune with what Schrader is getting at with this trilogy, and I'm optimistic. I haven't heard too much about what it's actually about. I've heard that it's very controversy baiting, but the film has been underseen enough that nothing has really come of that. I'm just really curious, and I trust Paul Schrader.
Yeah, definitely. And this was one I definitely was going back and forth whether to put on my list or not, because I do love Paul Schrader as a filmmaker, and I do love both First Reformed and The Card Counter. But I have, again, it was one of those things where I feel like it's, even though it doesn't have distribution yet, but I feel like it's going to happen very soon. Well, so, that's why I stuck with checking out other films just in that
you would think that a film with Joel Edgerton and Sigourney Weaver would get big distribution, but The Card Counter got a blink and you'll miss it release after showing at Sydney Film Festival here in Sydney, and First Reformed didn't show in cinemas at all, so I'll try and take the opportunity to see it at MIFF.
For sure. I'm interested to see this one as well. Like, I actually shamefully fell asleep in the cinema during The Card Counter and haven't had I'm not going to say I haven't had the chance to revisit it, but I haven't revisited it yet. But the parts I've had, I do remember of The Card Counter, I thought were excellent and perhaps even better than First Reformed. And I absolutely loved that film.
Yeah, I also think it was better as well, honestly.
I also think that's Oscar Isaac's easily his best performance he's ever given. I'm interested in Master Gardener. Don't know too much about it. I do remember some people snarkily saying that, Tar was a better Paul Schrader film than Master Gardener and all that sort of stuff. But, like, you know, that's a bit whatever. But it's Paul Schrader. I have faith in him. Just don't read too many of his Facebook posts and you'll still have faith in him too. But
I think, that I was going to say when I said I trust Paul Schrader, I was going to say, his films, not necessarily his social media posting. But yeah, to be honest, I don't really care. You know, he's not out committing crimes, as far as I know. Old uncles are entitled to say un-PC stuff on Facebook, and life goes on. It doesn't really concern me. I'm just interested in his artistic output.
Yeah, the point when he starts posting like right wing minions memes, that's the point when you're like, yep, no, he's too far gone now.
Yeah, he hasn't gone there yet.
All right, and to finish off the draft, Bede, the final pick, you have the honors.
All right, well, I got to go with another big heavy hitter, and it's from a filmmaker who I'm a huge fan of, and I can't wait to see this film. And that, of course, is Kim Ji-woon's Cobweb, which I love a lot of Ji-Woon Kim's films, and the fact that his latest one will be playing at MIFF, and the fact that it's also a film that is about filmmaking, and also it's a comedy as well, that has me even more intrigued, and him teaming up with a lot of the same actors he has worked with on previous projects, like Song Kang-ho as well, who's in the lead. I'm just very excited to see this one. Like, I don't know, like, other than the initial premise, I don't know what to expect, but I'm very excited to see Cobweb.
I caught about half of this movie, actually, in Sydney. Oh. I was too tired, but and I had various things colliding, but it's very tone shifting, very kind of loud, and not in a bad way. It's like heightened Korean melodramatic comedy is how I would describe it. Yeah, it's worth checking out for sure. I owe it a viewing of the rest of it, honestly.
Well, when you say Korean melodramatic drama, I'm immediately thinking K-drama, but I feel like it's going to be a little bit more sophisticated and have a bit more depth than those sorts of things. Not to say there's anything wrong with K-drama, but...
Well, yeah, it's not like a K-drama. It's very much like a throwing things at the wall kind of movie with a lot of like heightened acting style and absurd twists.
Yeah, well, I find Korean cinema is excellent at that. Like, you know, I feel like they have a grasp on tone and switching between tone and genre, I think, better than I think any other national cinema in the world really does. Kim Ji-woon is a bit of a blind spot for me, actually. I think the only film I've seen of his was, I think, the one movie he made in the US, which was that dumb Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. Okay. What was it? The one with Johnny, The Last Stand?
Last Stand.
So, I saw The Devil is a shameful blind spot for me, and like a lot of his other films. But like, it'll be interesting to see if this is, you know, a film about filmmaking. I don't know if like it's gonna be, if there's gonna be some sort of metatextual or like autobiographical things he's going to put into this Song Kang-ho character in there, and if that's going to be an interesting sort of introduction to his work, similarly to how Pain and Glory was a very weird introduction to Pedro Almodovar for me. So yeah, we'll see.
It's probably, I don't know enough about him to say whether it's extremely autobiographical, but it wouldn't surprise me. He's not credited as the writer, but he said it at the Sydney Film Festival that the script was not a traditional film script, and he did a lot of liberal adapting of it, and I think he put a lot of himself in it. I suspect that anyway.
All right, well, that is the draft completed. We have 18 films between the three of us, and just before we sign off, we will recap. We'll say all of the films that we selected, starting with Bead.
Yeah, well, with the ones on my list are Cobweb, Late Night with the Devil, Ansel, The Rooster, Anatomy of a Fall.
I picked Showing Up, Inside the Yellow Cocoon Shell, Four Daughters, Shaida, La Chimera, and Master Gardener.
And my films were The Eternal Daughter, The Sweet East, This Is Going to Be Big, No Bears, Bird Eater, and In Pursuit of Repetitive Beats. Now, guys, that is just 18 of the 260-plus films. That's not even... We haven't even covered 10% of the program. So a reminder, it is happening all across the Melbourne CBD from August 3rd to the 20th. To see the whole program, to book tickets, to book passes, cinema times, venues, the whole shebang, just go to miff.com.au. That is MIFF for Melbourne International Film Festival. The draft is done. So is the episode. Thank you all for listening. And a big thank you to Bea Jamine and Chris Evans for joining us. Chris, thanks for joining. Where can people find you? I don't know. You're a bit of a Luddite these days, but whereabouts are you? Yeah,
I'm launching a YouTube channel soon called Have You Seen It? I've got too much footage and secured the domains, but I've Yeah, you'll see that soon. Otherwise, look up Film Fight Club on wherever you find podcasts and skip all the episodes of podcasts about Fight Club that you find. Yeah.
Yep. So I still, from time to time, you did an episode on Nicolas Cage films where you did the Holy Trinity of Nicolas Cage films of The Rock, Con Air, and Face Off. And I still go back to that like probably every 2 months because it is probably the best episode you've done. And it's just so entertaining. And I feel like after a while, you, Glenn, and Virat started to lose your minds a little bit in that recording.
We did. I think that might have been in the middle of the pandemic when we were, you know, holding on to sanity by a thread anyway. And then that just pushed us further into lunacy. But wouldn't have it any other way.
No worries. And we wouldn't have it any other way than to, you know, your open invitation to this podcast. Come back anytime.
Cheers, man.
As for you too, Bede, but you already have too many podcasts that where people can hear you on, but, you know, happy to have you here. You know, tell us about the Super Network, the 2B Tuesdays, Bede and the Living Dead, all of the shows that you, all of the good stuff that you do.
Yeah, well, if people want to listen to the six or seven shows I'm doing at the moment. I have way too many podcasts. So basically, people want to listen to the ones I do over at the Super Network, which I co-host with Super Marcy, which, of course, are the Super Podcast, Podcasters of Horror, the King Zone Podcast, the Ozboy Cast, which you
guessed it on a while back, Sean. What are we talking about? Mad Dog Morgan. That was good fun.
Yeah, we did. And among other movies as well, which I think you're still traumatized that I subjected you to. Yeah. But
what was that weird sex movie you made me watch that was basically like borderline? Oh, Phantasm. Yeah, that was borderline pornography. That was
Yeah, it pretty much was. So that's there, and also the 2B Tuesdays podcast as well. And, of course, my solo podcast, Bede versus the Living Dead, which you can listen to all these shows out there on all podcast streaming services everywhere. And they're all catered to all different types of genres of films, so definitely give those a listen.
How far into the remakes or like different versions of Night of the Living Dead are you into now?
I have just recorded, as of last night, my 19th Jesus. Episode of the show. And I've already covered... Well, that's the thing. It depends on the episode, because sometimes I might be discussing one Night of the Living Dead remake, or it could be two, depending. So, and it's been a mixture. So it's been a mixture of both film, musicals. I've also done short films. I kind of pay homage to the film, re-edits and homages. And also a couple of artificial follow-ups as well. And in the recent recording, which will be out in a couple of weeks, I talk about two episodes of two separate TV shows that use Night of the Living Dead as the main aspect of their stories.
Yeah, it's a fascinating idea for a podcast, and I feel like it's going to get to the day where you've posted your last episode and you're like, finally, I've covered it all, and then... There's like it's being remade again, and then you know you throw your headphones to the ground.
Well, not only that, like I've already heard about a whole bunch of new ones that are coming in the future. Like there's two separate Night of the Living Dead 2s, like one from the director of Nanny, which is on Amazon Prime, and another one that features the cast of the original Day of the Dead. And also I found out that Tubi's producing their own sequel to Night of the Living Dead called Festival of the Dead that's directed by the Soska sisters. So that's coming out. And also this, like it's pretty much a never-ending source of material for me on this show. So I'm going to be talking about Night of the Living Dead forever.
Just let poor George Romero rest in peace.
That wouldn't be appropriate for his body of work though, would it?
Well, that is true. That is very true.
Yeah, I guess so. Yep. It's too late. We need it. You can tell it's been a while since I've done this. Like, I did an episode in April this year when I talked about Air and the Mario Brothers movie, and I'm like, this is the grand return of ABMP. I'm finally going to be back. And that was like 3 months ago. But now we're back. Whether we stay on a regular basis is... Who the fuck knows?
But well, it's good on you for making another one. Okay, whether or not this makes it into the episode, you decide. But while I have you here, what did you think of Air? I ask because I just got into an argument with someone the other day when talking about Barbie, where I referred to Air as also an ad.
Yeah, it absolutely is an ad.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of this new wave of, like, I guess, corporate, like...
Let's just celebrate products, like, these and deals.
These corporate success stories that are, like... But what's most surprising to me now, and I think I said this on the episode I did with Harris Dang about Mario Brothers and Air, it's like, why is this happening now, and how did this not happen 10 years ago in the wake of The Social Network? Like, I thought that would have been the time when all of these sorts of movies came out, but then we've got, like, the Blackberry movie, there was Air, what else has there been?
The Social Network is very critical, and Air is just a celebration. And, yeah, like, you know, the Flaming Hot Cheetos movie based on a lie.
That's right. There's the. I mean, to a lesser extent, there's, like, the Gamergate movie, which is coming out in a couple of months. Oh, no, not Gamergate. GameStop. Yeah.
Yeah. Although that's a little different, but still factors into the question that these films raise for me, which is, like, when there's this much limited resources available for mid-budget films, not based on huge IP, are these really the stories that we want to be watching and making? Well,
you got to put a $1 billion enterprise in somewhere, even into the smaller movies, I guess. But, like, I've heard that Blackberry is a little bit more, like, you know, because Blackberry is a company that doesn't really exist anymore, so, like, they can have a little bit more fun with it and be a little bit more critical. But because the brands are still around, they can't, you know, do that.
Could be a little bit more Social Network.
Yeah,
Tetris, that's what fits in the broader.
Tetris does too. Well, I mean, on this, like, if there's one story that I want to see made into a movie like this, it's the Atari story. Like, how have we not got that yet? Because the Atari story is insane.
Yeah, that would be fascinating.
Anyway, I think that can stay in.
Yeah, cool.
And that's our review of Barbie.
Yeah, indeed.
It's fine. It's a toy ad, but it's fine.
Yeah, my whole thing about Barbie was I just kind of got the sense that, like, the whole thing is a nightmare, that everyone's saying this movie is amazing. Look, fair play to you if you enjoy the movie. I've enjoyed movies that have dubious kind of source material as well. And I don't want to take away from anyone's enjoyment of the film, right? Because lots of people seem to love it. But it seems kind of nightmarish to me that the entire media and everyone you know who's into film and all the people who aren't into film are all talking about this movie that, despite presenting itself as subversive, only ever does so to the extent that it would benefit the brand. That everyone's been psyoped into participating into this huge marketing campaign. To me, it's just like, look at the bigger picture. You know, we shouldn't be just bowing to even more of a corporate takeover of the art form than has already been going on for decades. But that's just me. I'm super cynical about some things, and marketing is one of them.
Yeah, Bede being really quiet here, and he's just going to say, well, I, for one, accept our new Barbie overlords.
Well, I haven't seen the movie yet, so I can't say. But I mean, at the same time, though, I do find it, like, I mean, I can definitely see your point, but then at the same time, you know, there are some people out there who kind of say the same thing, have the same criticisms, but yet they also love the Lego movie or something like that. So,
yeah,
like, it's, you know, to me, it's all the same. And I think it's at the end of the day, if you do something that's, you do something interesting with it, like, at the end of the day, all these things are going to be selling products at the end of the day. But for me, like, as long as they do something interesting with the story, and rather than, you know, just making just a big long commercial, as long as you do something interesting with it, then I will definitely give it a lot of leeway. I mean, it doesn't, marketing and stuff like that in films doesn't really bother me that much, unless it's being very aggressive about it. But other than that, I mean, I look forward to seeing the film, but most of the time it doesn't really bother me that much.
There's parts in the movie where they're like throwing clothes out into the air, and there's like a freeze frame, and it's almost like a product pack shot, essentially.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I think where it got me with Barbie, where like we all knew going in it was an ad, but I was, you know, kind of excited to see it anyway. But the way that it attempts to address those criticisms in advance by having the meta angle of Mattel executives as characters in the movie, I wish they just hadn't even gone there. It got too much into I'm being manipulated by an ad that doesn't want me to think of it as an ad, so they're getting ahead of my criticisms in advance, and like I just could not turn off the cynicism. I wish it had just been dumb like the Lego movie, which I enjoyed.
I agree with you with an extent for most of the stuff that you've said, but part of me is also like, if this is almost sort of like a way for most people to engage with film in a more critical sort of aspect, and I know it probably won't, but like the things that Greta does with this film to sort of attempt to just, you know, use a sort of, I mean, to use a cinematic language of any kind in this sort of film might make people cloy on, not cloy, that's not the right word, but maybe get more general audiences to grab on to a sort of any sense of media literacy, I guess, because that is at an all-time low right now.
But if you look at the blockbusters that have been successful this year, and there haven't been many of them, they've been the ones that have been a bit experimental with the form. People like experimentation. People like new things. Like, look at Into the Spider-Verse with the weird animation. People love that. I haven't seen Oppenheimer yet. I'm seeing it tomorrow. But, you know, it sounds again like it's Nolan playing with the form.
Yeah, it's his masterpiece. I think I can fairly wholeheartedly say I think it is his masterpiece.
I'm very psyched.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing that too. Sweet. So,
we should do the sign off now, and then we can just talk it for a bit longer.
All right.
We can all figure this out. And thank you once again for listening. Please make sure to you don't have to listen to me to listen to all their plugs, because now I'm going to put all of those in the show notes now. But yeah, just hit subscribe if you enjoyed this. Subscribe. You might get more episodes soon. You might not. I don't know. Let's see where this podcast takes us. But I have some ideas for things I want to do with this podcast in the future, so stick around and you'll get them hopefully sooner rather than later. Thank you to Beat and Chris for joining. Thanks for listening, everybody. And until next time, we will see you later. Bye-bye.